Jack's going to read a really cute story. But the poems that I have to read are all more or less based on scripture. The first thing that I would like to read is a cycle of sonnets by John Donne, who was one of the metaphysical poets from about 1570-something to 1631. There are seven of these sonnets, and even though they are not all about Christmas, because of the way the cycle is constructed, I want to read them all so you can get the effect. Each sonnet begins with the last line of the previous sonnet, and then the last one ends with the first line of the first sonnet. So it forms a complete circle, and in fact it's called a crown. The first sonnet is called La Corona, the crown, and it is a prayer addressed to God. Deign at my hands this crown of prayer and praise, weaved in my low devout melancholy, thou which of good hast, yea, art treasury, all changing, unchanged, ancient of days. But do not with a vile crown of frail base reward my muse's white sincerity, but what thy thorny crown gained, that give me, a crown of glory which doth flower always. The ends crown our works, but thou crownest our ends. For at our end begins our endless rest. The first last end, now zealously possessed, with a strong sober thirst, my soul attends. 'Tis time that heart and voice be lifted high. Salvation to all that will is nigh. The second is Annunciation, and it is addressed to Mary. Salvation to all that will is nigh. That all which always is all everywhere, which cannot sin, and yet all sins must bear, which cannot die, yet cannot choose but die. Lo, faithful virgin, yields himself to lie in prison in thy womb. And though he there can take no sin, nor thou give, yet he'll wear, taken from thence, flesh, which death's force may try. Ere by the spheres time was created, thou wast in his mind, who is thy son and brother, whom thou conceivest, conceived. Yea, thou art now thy maker's maker, and thy father's mother. Thou shuttest light in dark, and shuttest in little room, immensity, cloistered in thy dear womb. Nativity addressed to Mary and to the poet's soul, to us. Immensity cloistered in thy dear womb, now leaves his well-beloved imprisonment. There he hath made himself to his intent weak enough now into our world to come. But oh, for thee, for him, hath the inn no room? Yet lay him in this stall, and from the Orient stars and wise men will travel to prevent the effect of Herod's jealous general doom. Seest thou, my soul, with thy faith's eyes, how he which fills all place, yet none holds him, doth lie? Was not his pity towards thee wondrous high, that would have need to be pitied by thee? Kiss him, and with him into Egypt go, with his kind mother, who partakes thy woe. The fourth is entitled Temple, and it is addressed to Joseph and to us. With his kind mother, who partakes thy woe, Joseph, turn back. See where your child doth sit, blowing, yea, blowing out those sparks of wit which himself on those doctors did bestow. The word but lately could not speak, and lo, it suddenly speaks wonders. Whence comes it that all which was, and all which should be writ, a shallow-seeming child should deeply know? His godhead was not sold to his manhood, nor had time mellowed him into this ripeness. But as for one which hath a long task, 'tis good, with the sun to begin his business. He in his age's morning thus began, by miracles exceeding power of man. Crucifying, a narrative addressed to us and to Christ. By miracles exceeding power of man, he faith in some, envy in some begat. For what meek spirits admire, ambitious hate. In both affections many to him ran, but oh, the worst are most. They will and can, alas, and do unto the Immaculate, whose creature fate is, now prescribe a fate, measuring self-life's infinity to a span, nay to an inch. Lo, where condemned he bears his own cross with pain, yet by and by, when it bears him, he must bear more and die. Now thou art lifted up, draw me to thee, and at thy death, giving such liberal dole, moist with one drop of thy blood my dry soul. Resurrection addressed to Christ. Moist with one drop of thy blood, my dry soul shall, though she now be in extreme degree too stony hard and yet too fleshly, be freed by that drop from being starved, hard or foul. And life, by this death abled, shall control death whom thy death slew. Nor shall to me fear of first or last bring misery. For if in thy life book my name thou enroll, flesh in that long sleep is not putrefied, but made that there of which and for which it was, nor can by other means be glorified. May then sins sleep and death soon from me pass, that waked from both, I again risen may salute the last and everlasting day. And ascension is addressed to us. Salute the last and everlasting day. Joy at the uprising of this sun and sun, ye whose just tears or tribulation have purely washed or burnt your drossy clay. Behold the highest, parting hence away, lightens the dark clouds which he treads upon. Nor doth he by ascending show alone, but first he, and he first, enters the way. O strong ram which hast battered heaven for me, mild lamb which with thy blood hast marked the path, bright torch which shinest that I the way may see, O with thine own blood quench thine own just wrath, and if thy Holy Spirit my muse did raise, deign at my hands this crown of prayer and praise. The second poem I would like to read for you is very short. It's called Lullaby 4, Roman numerals IV. It's by Anna Marie Ewing, who I believe is a contemporary American poet. His voice was faint in Bethlehem, as newborn babies' voices are, and yet it arrowed across the sand to fetch the doughty Balthazar. So weak the voice in Bethlehem, it scarcely reached the stable door. Yet from a distant eastern land, it drew the dauntless Melchior. A baby's voice in Bethlehem, more than most babies, indiscreet. Hush, Herod! Yet Caspar from Samarkand sped to the tiny, dangerous feet. The voice that wakened in Bethlehem slept nevermore in stall or bier. Brother wise men, do we still stand, listening with lion-hearted ear? The idea that the infant Christ was dangerous, she refers to the tiny dangerous feet. This idea is also expressed in a phrase from a poem by T.S. Eliot when he says, in the juvescence of the year came Christ the tiger. Mm. We often use the image of Christ as the lamb, but it's refreshing to also think of him as the tiger, the powerful, the one who changes lives. One of my favorite poems by T.S. Eliot is called The Journey of the Magi. It is told many, many years after the events of the Nativity by one of the wise men as he is an extremely old man and ponders back on the journey and what they found. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. a hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued, and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence of no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. You notice the reference to the three trees on the sky and the dicing for pieces of silver, a foreshadowing of the reason for which Christ came. The last poem I would like to read is entitled Star of the Nativity. And to me it is remarkable because it is included in Dr. Zhivago, the novel by Boris Pasternak. And I find it very moving that a poem of this sort should come out of communist Russia, Star of the Nativity. It was winter time. The wind blew from the plain and the infant was cold in the cave on the slope of a knoll. The breath of an ox served to warm him. The cattle were huddling within the cave. Warmth hovered in a mist over the manger. Up on a cliff, shepherds shook from their sheepskins the straws from their pallets and the stray grains of millet, and sleepily stared into the midnight distance. Far off were fields covered over with snow, and a graveyard and gravestones with fences, a cart with its shafts deep in a snowdrift, and over the graveyard a star-studded sky. And seemingly near, yet unseen until then, its light more timorous than that of a tallow dip set in the window of some watchman's hut, a star glimmered over the road to Bethlehem. Now it looked like a hayrick blazing off to one side from heaven and God, like the reflection of an arsonist fire, like a farmstead in flames or a threshing floor burning. It reared in the sky like a fiery stack of straw of hay, in the midst of a creation startled, astounded by this new star. An increasing redness that was like a portent was glowing above it. And three stargazers heeded and hasted to answer the call of these unwonted lights. Gift-laden camels plodded behind them, and caparisoned asses, each one smaller and smaller, were daintily, cautiously descending a hill. And all of the things that were to come after sprang up in the distance as a strange prevision. All the thoughts of the ages, all the dreams, all the worlds, all the future of galleries and of museums, all the pranks of goblins, all the works of the workers of miracles, all the Yule trees on earth, all the dreams of small children, all the warm glow of tremulous candles, all chains, all the magnificence of brightly hued tinsel. Ever more cruel, more raging, the wind blew from the plain. All the rosy-cheeked apples, all the blown glass, gold globes. Part of the pond was screened by alders, but beyond, rook nests among the treetops, part could be seen clearly from the brink of the cliff. The shepherds could mark well the camels and asses threading their way at the edge of the mill dam. "Let us go with all the others and worship the miracle," they said, and muffled their sheepskins about them. Falling through snow made their bodies feel warm. Tracks of bare feet, glinting like mica, led over the bright plain and beyond the inn's hut. And the dogs, sighting these tracks by the star's light, growled at them as if at a candle end's flame. The frosty night was like a fairy tale, and some beings from the snow-crushed mountain ridge were mingling constantly, unseen, with all the others. The dogs were wavering, looking back in terror, and in dire foreboding, cringed close to a young shepherd. Through the same countryside, over the same highway, some angels walked among the throng of mortals. Their incorporeality made them invisible, yet each step they took left the print of a foot. Day was breaking. The trunks of the cedars stood out. A horde of men milled by the stone at the cave's mouth. "Who are you?" Mary asked them. "We are from a shepherd tribe and envoys of heaven. We have come to sing praises to both of you. You cannot all enter. Bide a while here." In the gloom before dawn, gray as cold ashes, the drovers and shepherds stamped to keep warm. Those came on foot bickered with those who came mounted. Near the hollowed-out log that served as a water trough, the camels bellowed, the gray asses kicked out. Day was breaking. Dawn swept the last of the stars off heaven's walls as if they were ash motes. And Mary, out of all the countless multitude, allowed only the Magi to enter the cleft in the crag. He slept, all refulgent, in a manger of oak wood, like a moonbeam within a deep hollowed tree. In lieu of sheepskins, his body was warmed by the lips of an ass and nostrils of an ox. The Magi stood in shadow. The buyer seemed in twilight. They spoke in whispers, groping for words. Suddenly, one in a deeper shadow touched another to move him aside from the manger, a little to the left. The other turned. Like a guest about to enter, the star of the Nativity was gazing upon the maid.
I have a story by Lincoln Steffens. It appeared first in his autobiography in 1931. It was called A Miserable Merry Christmas. What interested me in our new neighborhood was not the school nor the room I was to have in the house all to myself, but the stable which was built back of the house. My father let me direct the making of a stall, a little smaller than the other stalls, for my pony. And I prayed and hoped, and my sister Lou believed that that meant that I would get the pony, perhaps for Christmas. I pointed out to her that there were three other stalls and no horses at all. This I said in order that she should answer it. She could not. My father said that someday we might have horses and a cow. Meanwhile, a stable added to the value of a house. Someday is a pain to a boy who lives in and knows only now. My good little sisters, to comfort me, remarked that Christmas was coming, but Christmas was always coming. And grown-ups were always talking about it, asking what you wanted and then giving you what they wanted you to have. Though everybody knew what I wanted, I told them all again. My mother knew that I told God, too, every night. I wanted a pony. And to make sure that they understood, I declared that I wanted nothing else. "Nothing but a pony?" my father asked. "Nothing. Not even a pair of high boots?" Oh, that was hard. I did want boots, but I stuck to the pony. "No, not even boots. Nor candy?" "There ought to be something to fill your stocking with, and Santa Claus can't put a pony into a stocking." That was true. And he couldn't lead a pony down the chimney either. But no. All I want is a pony, I said. If I can't have a pony, give me nothing. Nothing. Now, I had been looking myself for the pony I wanted, going to sale stables, inquiring of horsemen, and I had seen several that would do. My father let me try them. I chose several, but my father always found some fault with them. I was in despair. When Christmas was at hand, and I had given up all hope of a pony, and on Christmas Eve, I hung up my stocking along with my sisters, of whom, by the way, I now had three. I haven't mentioned them or their coming because you understand they were girls. And girls, young girls, counted for nothing in my manly life. They did not mind me either. They were so happy that Christmas Eve that I caught some of their merriment. I speculated on what I'd get. I hung up the biggest stocking I had, and we all went reluctantly to bed to wait till morning, not to sleep, not right away. We were told that we must not only sleep promptly, but that we must not wake up until 7:30 the next morning, or if we did, we must not go to the fireplace for our Christmas. Impossible. We did sleep that night. But we woke up at 6 a.m. We lay in our beds and debated through the open doors whether to obey till, say, 6:30. Mm-hmm. Then we bolted. I don't know who started it, but there was a rush. We all disobeyed. We raced to disobey and get to the fireplace in the front room downstairs. And there they were, the gifts. All sorts of wonderful things. Mixed up piles of presents. Only, as I disentangled the mess, I saw that my stocking was empty. It hung limp, not a thing in it. And under and around it, nothing. My sisters had knelt down, each by her pile of gifts. They were squealing with delight, till they looked up and saw me standing there in my nightgown, with nothing. They left their piles to come to me and look with me at my empty place. Nothing. They felt my stocking. Nothing. I don't remember whether I cried at that moment, but my sisters did. They ran with me back to my bed, and there we all cried till I became indignant. That helped some. I got up, dressed, and driving my sisters away, I went alone out into the yard, down to the stable, and there, all by myself, I wept. My mother came out to me by and by. She found me in my pony stall, sobbing on the floor. She tried to comfort me, but I heard my father outside. He had come partway with her, and she was having some sort of angry quarrel with him. She tried to comfort me, besought me to come to breakfast. I could not. I wanted no comfort and no breakfast. She left me and went on to the house with sharp words with my father. I don't know what kind of a breakfast the family had. My sisters said it was awful. They were ashamed to enjoy their own toys. They came to me and I was rude. I ran away from them. I went around to the front of the house, sat down on the steps, and the crying over, I ached. I was wronged. I was hurt. I can feel now what I felt then. And I am sure that if one could see the wounds upon our hearts, there would be found still upon mine a scar from that terrible Christmas morning. And my father, the practical joker, he must have been hurt too, a little. I saw him looking out of the window. He was watching me or something for an hour or two, drawing back the curtain ever so little lest I catch him, but I saw his face, and I think I can see now the anxiety in it, the worried impatience. After, I don't know how long, surely an hour or two, I was brought to the climax of my agony by the sight of a man riding a pony down the street. A pony in a brand new saddle. The most beautiful saddle I ever saw, and it was a boy's saddle. The man's feet were not in the stirrups, his legs were too long. The outfit was perfect. It was the realization of all my dreams, the answer to all my prayers. A fine new bridle with a little curved bit, and the pony. As he drew near, I saw that the pony was really a small horse, what we used to call an Indian pony. A bay with black mane and tail, and one white foot, and a white star on his forehead. For such a horse as that, I could have given, I could have forgiven anything. But the man, a disheveled fellow with a blackened eye and a fresh cut face, came along reading the numbers on the houses, and as my hopes, my impossible hopes, rose, he looked at our door and passed by, he and the pony, and the saddle, and the bridle. Too much. I fell upon the steps, and having wept before, I broke now into such a flood of tears that I was a floating wreck when I heard a voice. "Say, kid, do you know a boy named Lenny Steffens?" I looked up. It was the man on the pony, back again at our house block. "Yes, that's me." "Well, then this is your horse. I've been looking all over for you and your house. Why don't you put numbers on it where it can be seen?" "Get down," I said, running out to him. He went on saying something about, "Ought to have been here at 7 o'clock. Told me to bring the nag here and tie him up to your post and leave him for you. But hell, I got into a drunk and a fight and a hospital and..." "Get down," I said. He got down and he boosted me up in the saddle. He offered to fit the stirrups to me, but I didn't want him to. I wanted to ride. "What's the matter with you?" he said. "What are you crying for? Don't you like this horse? He's a dandy, this horse. I know him of old. He's fine at cattle. He'll drive him alone." I hardly heard. I could scarcely wait, but he persisted. He adjusted the stirrups, and then finally off I rode, slowly, at a walk, so happy, so thrilled, that I did not know what I was doing. I did not look back at the house or the man. I rode off up the street, taking note of everything, of the reins, of the pony's long mane, of the carved leather saddle. I had never seen anything so beautiful. And mine, I was going to ride up past Miss Kay's house. But I noticed on the horn of the saddle some stains, like raindrops. So I turned and trotted home, not to the house, but to the stable. There was the family. Father, mother, sisters, all working for me, all happy. They had been putting in place the tools of my new business, blankets, curry comb, brush, pitchfork, everything. And there was hay in the loft. "What did you come back so soon for?" somebody asked. "Why didn't you go on riding?" I pointed to the stains. "I wasn't going to get my new saddle rained on," I said. And my father laughed. "It isn't raining. Those aren't raindrops. They're tears," my mother gasped, and she gave my father a look which sent him off to the house. Worse still, my mother offered to wipe away the tears still running out of my eyes. I gave her such a look as she had given him, and she went off after my father, drying her own tears. My sisters remained, and we all unsaddled the pony, put on his halter, led him to his stall, tied and fed him. It began really to rain. So all the rest of that memorable day, we curried and combed that pony. The boys plaited his mane, forelock and tail, while I pitchforked hay to him, and I curried and brushed. For a change, we brought him out to drink. We led him up and down, blanketed like a racehorse. We took turns at that. But the best, the most inexhaustible fun was to clean him. When we went reluctantly to our midday Christmas dinner, we all smelt of horse. And my sister My sisters had to wash their faces and hands. I was asked to. But I wouldn't till my mother bade me look in the mirror. Then I washed up quick. My face was caked with the muddy lines of tears that had coursed over my cheeks to my mouth. Having washed away that shame, I ate dinner. And as I ate, I got hungrier and hungrier. It was my first meal that day. As I filled up on the turkey and the stuffing, the cranberries and the pies, the fruit and the nuts, as I swelled, I could laugh. My mother said I still choked and sobbed now and then, but I laughed. I saw and enjoyed my sister's presence till I had to go out and attend to my pony, who was there, really and truly there. The promise, the beginning of a happy double life. And I went and looked to make sure. There was the saddle, too, and the bridle. But that Christmas, which my father had planned so carefully, was it the best or the worst I ever knew? He often asked me that. I never could answer as a boy. I think now that it is both. It covered the whole distance, from broken-hearted misery to bursting happiness, too fast. A grown-up could hardly have stood it.
This summer, we had at different times people that helped the community to participate in dramas. And I thought it was one of the nicest things of the summer because I love that kind of thing anyway. But Chuck Numerick was one of the people that was up helping the community to do plays and things. And he wrote this poem about the humanity of Mary as well as the real humanness of Christ's birth. And it's just a very short poem, but I would like to read it for you first. It's called Child of My Delight. Child of my delight, you nestle at my breast so peacefully in search of sleep, and I am weak with happiness that you are here. The months of fear and shame are far away, and I believe in miracles, as I believe that you may be the most important baby ever born. When morning comes, I may resent your cries and helplessness. But now, when you have just appeared mysterious from my womb and time and earth have stopped to give you room, now is what the waiting means, though all may not be as it seems. Keep your eyes open a moment, long enough to see the man beside me here, who took us in before he knew how beautiful you'd be, long before he ever thought of trusting me. Call him Father, though he cannot be, but somehow we must give him back the love he gave to us so willingly. Since you came here tonight, I have not been alone. I could have not known a night like this would bring so many changes. Strangers came tonight who frightened me. Drunken shepherds, Joseph says. But they claimed that they came seeking you and me specifically. That wonders in the stars foretold, a child born this day will be king. I thought I heard them singing angel songs before they came and when they went away. I believe that this must be a holy night, and somehow I am part of it. I should be singing praises and songs. I should be on my knees, but I can only stare in awe at you who came in love and mystery, convinced that part of me will never leave this place and may someday, in joy or pain, return to learn its lessons once again. I collect Christmas stories, and for the last, I don't know how many years, we've had a new Christmas story to read to our family at Christmas time. And Karnstrom's sister, Sonia, who was here this summer, knew that I collected Christmas stories, and she sent me one in the mail. It's new to me, but it's very beautiful. It's a Serbian folk tale by Ruth Sawyer, and I'd like to share it with you. It was midsummer when the great storm came. It swept down through the cut into the mountains, into the peaceful valley, ripping off roofs and lying flat fields of grain, swelling the river to overflowing.
The men worked throughout the night to keep their herds, their sheep and goats, driving them to high land. And when the sickly yellow dawn broke, no life had been lost and one gained. On a rock, jutting high over the river, a young child was found, crying pitifully. He was a swarthy, dark-skinned child, and whatever clothes he might have worn, the storm had stripped from him. He was too young to do more than babble a few words, and these words were in the gypsy tongue. His looks, too, spoke of the Sagani, the gypsies. It was Father Janowicz who found him and brought him to his own cottage, while Mother Janowicz was dipping the porridge into the bowls for their own children. Her arms reached out for him, as mother's arms will, for all helpless ones, and she wrapped him warm in a scrap of blanket. She quieted his sobbing and fed him from her own bowl. "He is of the Sagani. We will not keep him," said Father Janowicz.
"But he is little and helpless. Watch his eyes." Mother Janowicz passed her hand up and down in front of his face, and there was no blinking. Then she took a candle that still burned and passed it close so that the wick almost singed his long dark lashes. But his eyes remained wide open and staring. "You see," she said, "he is blind. You found him, and it is the will of God that we should keep him." And for that one and only time, she gathered the blind boy close to her heart and held him there, crooning soft, loving words over him. Now the valley dwellers of Serbia are hard-working, honest folks and deeply rooted to their land, but they do not love the Sagani. They point to the caravans passing through and say, "There go the tricksters and the thieves, there go the accursed of the earth. Let no man among us give them harborage." But for all their rascally ways, the gypsies did have some virtues. They could tell amazing fortunes, and they were known to have prophecy and prophesy the great happenings of the world. And they were good farmers and pot menders, and their music is much beloved by all people. But in that long ago time, they were accursed. And the Janowiczes remembered only this as the blind boy grew older. They called him Marco after their greatest hero, partly in mockery and partly because the boy, like the ancient Marco, loved all small creatures and had a very strange way with them. He would call the birds from the woods and they would feed out of his hand, and a wounded hare or fox would come whimpering to him for aid, and he had tenderness and understanding for all living things. Marking this, the Janowiczes set him at an early age to tend their sheep. Summers he slept with the sheep in the pastures, and winters he burrowed under the straw in the shed, holding himself in like a wild creature against the cold. He learned quickly and would have called creature and man alike his brother had man not despised him so. Because he saw less than other human beings, he heard more. His fingers and his bare feet soon made him familiar with all the countryside, feeling their way through pastures and woods and along the riverbank. Only upon the village road was he a stranger. 6 years after the great storm, an old shepherd came from Dalmatia and crossed his pasture and stopped to make himself friendly. He bore a pipe, self-made, and discovering the boy's blindness, he played tunes on it and gave it into the boy's hands that he might feel out the fashioning of the pipe. That summer, Marco found a young willow and made his own pipe. And before the frost came, the boy was making music of his own, strange, wild, haunting music. It stirred the hearts of the passers-by, and it filled the valley dwellers with wonder. Before another summer had passed, tales, hard to believe, were being bandied about by them. Some told how on a gentle night when the moon was full overhead, they had heard the lad piping to the lambs and had seen the lambs on their hind legs dancing to music. Others had seen him pipe the wild hares out of the copses and set them to frolicking in time to the tune as free as the wind. Mother Janowicz did not stint him with his food, but it was ladled out of the big pot and his bowl was given him to take outside of the kitchen to eat. Summers he ate in the pasture and winters in the shed.
Only in bitter weather was he bidden inside to share the warmth of the fire. They were not really unkind, but only that he was set apart from the other children, from all humankind. The valley dwellers made him an outcast from their home and village life. Do you know what this means, to be cast out of all festivals, all merrymaking? To be forbidden entrance to the church? Once he dared to ask why this should be. You are of the Tsagani, cursed by all the world. The church, God Christ, and his blessed mother are not for you, Mother Janowicz said, but not without a lot of unkindness. Father Janowicz said it more sternly, but the children taunted him with it so that he gave up watching them depart for church all in their best clothes, listening secretly to the music coming from its door, wide opened to everyone but him. He became a silent boy, save for the music he made and the words he sometimes sang between the pipings. His elders marked this with approval and quoted an old Slav proverb, "He who preserves silence speaks well." In lambing time, Marco watched over the ewes so well that rarely a lamb was lost. Those that came into the world too feeble to fight for themselves the first few hours, he warmed against his own body under his tunic. And for all his blindness, he would have been a happy boy had the people of the valley made him a dweller with them. Yet, in an odd way, they were very proud of him and stood in awe of his powers to make music and to call wild things to him. They listened to his songs and pipings, and often a stranger coming into the valley would hear a farmer plowing behind his oxen singing, "Plow, plow, break the good soil, seed for the sowing, sun for the growing, harvest and thrash the grain, fill the full measure, bread for the making, straw for the baking. Fathers and mothers and little ones gather, let bread be broken, let thanks be spoken. 'Tis a good song, a new one to me, from where does it come?" This the man from the north or south would ask, and the farmer would answer, "Oh, 'tis only a jingle made up by one of our shepherds, a blind boy, a not one of us, you understand." Oh, how often Marco heard this, yet it tied no strings to his pipe, it hung no bitterness across his heart. But he did know sorrow. And every time he looked up the valley where the church bell rang, every time he listened to the gathering of the dancers in the village square, and old Stefan making music on his fiddle, his sorrow deepened. But it was worse at Christmas time. To have no part in all the gaiety and the beauty of Christ's holy eve and day, this brought a full weight of sorrow. To lie in the cold and dark of the holy eve, just before the midnight service, and to hear Mother Janowicz waking up the rest of the children, "Come, Vuki, come, Ivo, come, Yaga. We make haste to make. But never, come, Marco." To hear the bustling, the calling of one another to the cottage, and to know that he was the outcast forbidden to have part in the Christ service, and later to hear the hurrying of the feet along the road, that made a sorrow so much of a load that it was almost too much to bear. Once he followed, feeling his way across the barnyard to the road, following the sound of the ringing bell. If he could not enter, at least he would stand at the door and listen, and coming home he could whisper the part that he was forbidden to sing in the carols. But his feet did not know the valley road. There were no familiar stones, rises, or hollows to guide him. All was confusion until, having stumbled off and on again many times, fear set in. He tumbled and somehow stumbled back to the shed, and there he lay in the straw, shaking with cold and fright. The priest, a kindly man, tried to teach him something of the Church of God and of the birth of Christ, so that he would not die and live in absolute ignorance. He would often stop when the boy was tending sheep and sit with him for an hour or so, and the boy would ask questions. "This God, he is the big king?" asked Marco. "Well, you may call him that, lad." "And the Christ, who is the baby Jesus in the manger, he is the small king, yes?" "Even so." And Mary, she was the small king's mother and very holy. "Are they all in the church yonder?" "Well, they are in heaven, only their images are in the church." "But if I entered, I could feel their faces. I could feel each line until I would know them as I know my sheep. The old priest sighed. It is the law of the church. We cannot break it. The people of the valley would not permit it. They have consecrated the church with their vows, even as a bishop of long ago consecrated it with holy water. No Sagani may enter the church. And would my entering really defile it? So they think. When God bade Joseph and Mary and the child to flee to Egypt, the Sagani, the Egyptians, denied them shelter and food and care. It is a long tale. Sometime I will tell it to you. And for this I am accursed? Truly. And shall I never have a part in Christmas? Short of a miracle, never, my son, never. It is the mark you must bear, the mark of an outcast. Marco drew in his breath, and slowly he let it out with the words, take my hand, put it on the place where my body bears the mark, and I will cut it out. It lies not upon your body, my son, but upon your soul. There followed a great silence, and at last the boy asked the final question. Why do you call me my son? The old priest sighed again. Truly, I do not know. I am but a simple man. On Christmas Day early, it was the custom for the older boys to gather wood for the great village fire, where the suckling pigs would roast all day, turned out on their spits. Some one chosen boy would go from house to house and greet each household. The Christ is born, they would say. And the mother, scattering a handful of wheat to bring plenty into the house, would answer, in truth he is born. Then the boy would beat the Christ log on the hearth until a great streaming of sparks mounted up, and he would wish, make the holy Christmas bring as many sheep and goats and pigs and cattle as there have been sparks mounting up the chimney. Oh, Marco wished that he could have been that boy just once to wish plenty on the village. He wished that he might have taken his place just once for the great feast and had his share of the suckling pigs. But never for him. Had not the priest said it would take a miracle, nothing short would lift the curse. Oh, yet if he could not share the Christmas, worship in the church on Holy Eve and sing the carols, he would make a carol of his own and worship in the shed. That would not be so different from the place that the Bethlehem shepherds were said to have come and worshipped, where they had found the small king in the manger. Well, it happened on that year, when he was 12, that Father Janowicz had marked the years since the great storm, and notching with a sigh placed against an upright in the shed. And Marco, with his fingers, checked his age. He had been two thereabouts when he was rescued, and there were now 10 notches on the side. The Holy Eve, a ewe lamb, had gotten herself tangled in a thorn tree, and becoming frightened, had jumped about so frantically that she had broken her leg. Marco had torn his tunic to strips, and taking the wood, had bound the leg. And kneeling, he had lifted her across his shoulders, holding her fast by her good legs, and had borne her to the shed, and laid her down in the corner of the straw. Now stretched beside her, he talked softly to her as if she had been kin and human. This is the night that Christ is born. We will keep this Christmas, thou and I. Thou shalt hear my carol, made through the long days of ripening wheat and birds wheeling southward, winds telling of winter. Thou shalt worship with me here when the stroke of the bells ring out from that church that we may not enter. The ewe lay quietly beside the boy, each warning the other. They slept a little, I think, awoke and slept again. And then, through the cold of approaching midnight, came the voice of Mother Janowicz calling her children. Come, Ruth, come, Eagle, come, Yaga. We must haste to make. If only she might call just once more, and call it joyfully. Come, Marco. But that would never be, short of a miracle. And when had a miracle taken place here in the valley? The blind boy's hand felt for the lamb, his fingers worked in and out of the thick fleece, and his other hand held his pipe close. Thou knowest it not, small one, but when a human stands in dire need of help, when great calamity comes and he needs a friend, a protector, one to be with him as might a brother be, he can ask for such help and it cannot be denied him. That is the law among the Serbian people. Dost thou not think that if I should pray this night in my great need, the holy ears of heaven might hear? There came from the road the sound of many feet, brisk and eager feet, young and old, and a slow ringing the bell began, calling all within the village to come and worship the newborn king. Marco rose to his knees and he spoke to the lamb, small one, I have heard it said that on Christmas Eve all dumb creatures kneel upon this hour that the Christ was born. Canst thou kneel? And as if at his bidding, the ewe lamb shook herself, rose up on her hind legs, even upon the one that had been broken, bent her forelegs on the straw, and again the blind boy's hand moved comfortingly through the thick fleece. He prayed, Big King, send one to sponsor me, one who will speak for me among the valley folk, for I would be as other boys, welcome at the table, called to church by the bell, having a share in the worship of Christ Eve. The bell stopped ringing, and Marco felt a stirring not far off. Feet rustled the straw, and then a strange hand was placed upon his shoulders. Marco spoke in wonder. Can words reach heaven faster than a bird flies? Some words can. Did the big king send you to be my sponsor? Perhaps. Perhaps to bear you company, that you need not spend the Christ Eve alone. Who are you? A boy, even as yourself. Are you blind? Not blind. But are you blind? Think. If people call me blind, and I would see the whole world, the whole wide world, and all that it holds. No one sees that. But think, in this little piece of the world that lies about you, have you not found more beauty than those who see? Do they know the small loveliness of a bird setter? Do they hear what the wind whispers? Have they caught the song that the morning star sings? And can they put all these things into music and play it on a pipe if you can? But I would see. It is not given for any one person in life to have too much. Would you bargain away your music for the power to see only what humans see? Think, Marco. I am thinking, and this I know, I would once see the face of the small king. A hush had fallen on the shed and on the valley and on the whole world. The words Marco heard were hardly whispered. Put your fingers on my face and trace every line slowly so you will remember. Lightly as winter snow, the hand of the blind boy touched the face held close to his own, tracing the forehead, feeling the wide set eyes, the rounded cheek, the slender clear-cut nose, the strong molded chin. He nodded, his own face lighting with exaltation as each feature became familiar, possessed. And he sighed with deep tranquility. I will keep the music. I will be a singer for the people of Serbia. He put his pipe to his lips and blew the tune for his carol, and between the pipings he sang the words that he had made. This is the Christmas to Mary most blessed. Jesus the Savior is born. These are the angels singing through heaven, all curses forever, this forgiven this morn. These are the shepherds, they seek for the stranger, they kneel at the manger to pray, and I, a blind shepherd, give prayer to the big king, give song to the small king this day. The midnight service over, the valley folk poured out upon the road.
and a dazzling light filled the sky. It shone over the whole valley. "It comes from there," someone said. "No, it comes from there. Come over yonder." Hands pointed everywhere, and the priest who had shepherded them to the doorway of the church pointed to the Janowitz's barn. "It's from there it comes," he said. He led the way, and when they came to the farmyard, they found a small, mean shed bathed in light. No word was spoken. Masked about the low doorway, they stood, unbelieving what their eyes told them. For they could see within, and kneeling on the straw was the blind boy, and kneeling with him was a small new lamb and the Christ. A circle of light shone above his head, making such brightness as the valley folk had never seen upon the earth. And they all bent their heads as in church worship. The old priest spoke in low humility. "The miracle. It is we who have been blind. It is upon our heads the curse comes home to rest." And picking up his robe, he knelt on the fringe of a straw, and the valley folk knelt with him, making no stir in the night. The blind boy piped on, singing his carol over and over again in his great gladness.
Mary and John kindly gave me a lovely book for Christmas called Where the Sidewalk Ends by Shel Silverstein. Lots of short poems, and I had only a chance to dip into it. But I found two that I thought might be suitable for today. The first is called Point of View. Thanksgiving dinners sad and thankless, Christmas dinners dark and blue, when you stop and try to see it from the turkey's point of view. Sunday dinner isn't sunny, Easter feasts are just bad luck, when you see it from the viewpoint of a chicken or a duck. Oh, how I once loved tuna salad, pork and lobsters, lamb chops too, till I stopped and looked at dinner from the dinner's point of view. The other is called Tug of War. I will not play at tug of war, I'd rather play at hug of war, where everyone hugs instead of tugs, where everyone giggles and rolls on the rug, where everyone kisses and everyone grins, and everyone cuddles and everyone wins.
I've got one more that takes about 8 minutes to read, but I will excuse everybody who's heard it, because it's a very popular story at the village, and it's Berries and Bunny. It's very sad, but it's a beautiful Christmas story. If you haven't heard it, you might want to hear Berries, but if you've heard it, please go. I don't want to. Well, if you want to, I just want to warn you what it is, and like Carnstrom, you can go. It's my favorite Christmas story. I really wasn't going to read it, but I just can't let Christmas go without reading it to somebody. If one of you will stay, all right. This is in a book called The Way of the Wolf by Martin Bell. Once upon a time in a large forest, there lived a very funny bunny. He had one lop ear and a tiny black nose and unusually shining eyes, and his name was Barrington. Barrington was not really a very handsome bunny. He was brown and speckled, and his ears didn't stand upright, but he could hop, and as I said, he was very furry. In a way, winter is fun for bunnies. After all, it gives them an opportunity to hop in the snow, and they turn around to see where they've hopped. So in a way, winter was fun for Barrington. But in another way, winter made Barrington sad. For you see, winter marked the time when all of the animal families got together in their cozy homes to celebrate Christmas. But he could hop, and he was very furry. And as far as Barrington knew he was the only bunny in the forest. When Christmas Eve finally came, Barrington did not feel like going home all by himself, so he decided that he would hop for a while in the clearing in the center of the forest. Hop, hop, hippity-hop. Barrington made tracks in the fresh snow. Hop, hop, hippity-hop. Then he cocked his head and looked back at the wonderful designs that he had made. Bunnies, he thought to himself, can hop, and they are very warm, too, because of how furry they are.
but Barrington didn't really know whether this was true of all bunnies, since he had never seen another bunny. When it got too dark to see his tracks that he was making, Barrington made his way to go home. On his way, however, he passed a large oak tree, and high up in the branches was a great deal of excited chattering going on. Barrington looked it up. It was the squirrel family. What a marvelous time the family seemed to be having. "Hello up there," cried Barrington. "Hello down there," came the reply. "Are you having a Christmas party?" "Oh, yes," answered the squirrel. "It's Christmas Eve. Everybody's having a Christmas party." "May I come to your party?" asked Barrington. "Are you a squirrel?" "No." "Well, what are you then?" "A bunny." "A bunny?" "Yes." "Well, how can you come to your party if you're a bunny? Bunnies can't climb trees." "Well, that's true," said Barrington thoughtfully, but I can hop, and I'm very furry, and I'm warm." "We're sorry," called the squirrel. "We don't know anything about hopping and being furry, but we do know that in order to come to our house, you'd have to be able to climb a tree." "Oh, well," said Barrington. "Merry Christmas." "Merry Christmas," chattered the squirrel. And the unfortunate bunny hopped off toward his tiny house. It was beginning to snow when Barrington reached the river. Near the riverbank was a wonderfully constructed house of sticks and mud, and inside there was singing. "Oh, it's the beavers," thought Barrington. "Maybe they'll let me come to their party." So he knocked at the door. "Who's out there?" called a voice. "Barrington Bunny," he replied. There was a long pause, and then a shiny beaver's head broke through the water. "Hello, Barrington," said the beaver. "Could I come to your Christmas party?" asked Barrington. The beaver thought for a while, and then he said, "Well, I suppose so, but do you know how to swim?" "No," said Barrington. "Oh, but I can hop, and I'm very furry, and I'm warm." "Well, sorry, I don't know anything about hopping and being furry, but I do know that in order to come to our house, you have to be able to swim." "Oh, well," said Barrington, his eyes filling with tears, "I suppose that's true. Well, Merry Christmas." "Merry Christmas," called the beaver, and he disappeared beneath the surface of the water. Even being as furry as he was, Barrington was beginning to get cold, and the snow was falling so hard that his tiny bunny eyes could scarcely see what was ahead of him. He was almost home, however, when he had heard the exciting squeaking of field mice beneath the ground. "It's another party," thought Barrington, and suddenly he blurted out through his teeth, "Oh, field mice, this is Barrington Bunny. Do you think I can come to your party?" Well, the wind was so howling so loudly, and Barrington was sobbing so much that no one heard him. And when there was no response at all, Barrington just sat down in the snow and began to cry with all his might. "Bunnies aren't any good at all. What good is it to be furry and to be able to hop if you don't have a family on Christmas Eve?" Barrington cried and cried, and when he stopped crying, he began to bite his bunny foot. Well, it was late when Barrington finally started home, and what made things worse, he knew that a blizzard was beginning. Hop, hop, hippity hop. Soon, poor Barrington was lost. The wind howled furiously, and it was cold, very, very cold. "It certainly is cold," he said in a loud voice to no one. "But it's a good thing I'm so furry. But if I don't find my way home pretty soon, even I might freeze."
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Who's the
Oh, baby, no. Just the end of the world. unto you in peace from God our Father and from our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen. The proclamation tonight is based upon one section of the gospel just read. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. And the proclamation has three brief sections to it. The first is a time for some silence. In this hymnal, there are suggestions that there be times of silence during the worship. Any people who know me know that I welcome that. My understanding is that the silence is suggested after the sermon. I take exception to that. I think it ought to be after the lesson. I think it has more for us to ponder when God's word is read than when someone speaks on it. So if we have still some freedom at Holden, when we have silences, they will often come after the lesson. I would like you to take the time to ponder those words, the word became flesh and dwelt among us. Ponder the essence of Christmas, what that means in your life, not only what it has meant to the world's life, but what it means in your life, and simply reflect upon that first. One of the reasons I'm asking them to come forward is because I want them to be able to see what I'm going to do on the floor, and I apologize to the adults who will miss out on that. But we'll wait for Evan. Come on, honey. How about Rachel? Come on, please. Just a minute ago, I said that tonight's proclamation is on some words that I think are pretty hard to understand for you. At least I'm guessing that. The words that I used were, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And I wanted a way in which I could proclaim to you what that means for us and why this is an important day. And I heard a story once, and that's what I want to share with you. Once there was a boy who went to Sunday school, and he heard what they taught there, and he heard on Christmas that the people who came to that church believed that that baby that was born was a special baby. He tried to understand that, but they also said that that baby was special because that baby was somehow God, and he couldn't believe that. So he stopped going to church. Many years later, he liked nature, and he was a good man. Many years later, he was out in the woods, and under a tree, there was some sandy soil, and he saw something crawling around. And he looked again, and it was an ant. Have you ever watched ants when they go down into an anthill and then go and get food? You know, they can carry more than they weigh. They carry food and go into an anthill. He realized there were a lot of ants and that they were crawling. And he also realized that the food was here, right about there, and that the anthill was right here. But apparently the first ant that found the food had found it by going over here and over here and over here. And then he took the food and he went over like that and he came back to the anthill and all the other ones went the same way. So there was a long line of ants and they were this far from the food. So he watched for a little bit and he took and he moved the sand so that it would be very easy to get from here to here. Didn't do any good at all. All of the ants went that way. So he took the food and he moved it over a little bit. Then what they did was to go all the way around here and also go from here to here and then go back. Then he thought, I know what I'll do. And right in front of the anthill, he built a great big pile of sand so that they were blocked and they'd have to go this way and then they'd see the food. So now they went and climbed that great big hill and went down and then went over there and then went here and then got the food and then came back and then came all the way up over the hill and went back down in the anthill. And he looked and he said finally in disgust, I can't teach them. The only way I could ever tell them anything is I'd have to become an ant. And I'd have to lead them over to the food and lead them back to the food. I just can't talk to them. And then he remembered, one time in church, that's what they were talking about. That God loved us so much, and he wanted to be able to speak to us, and the only way he could really do that was to become one of us. That's what Christmas is about. God became human so that he could tell us what he wanted to tell us, mainly that he loved us. That's what we're talking about tonight. I had two reasons to bring you up here. One is so that I could try to tell you, and the other so that the adults could understand at least that much of the sermon. Thank you.
Whoa.
The third part of the proclamation is try to find some words on the word. Christmas comes tough, so does Easter. Festivals have a great liability in that we work too hard at them. And when you're the one to proclaim it, you try to find a new way to say it. You try to be extra poetic, artistic, refreshing, new, and they tend to come hard. But Christmas is especially ironic when that's the case because the essence of it is its simplicity. It has been analyzed psychologically, theologically, poetically, artistically, and all we're really called to do is to announce again the mystery of Christmas, Christ's Mass. What we're supposed to do is to remind ourselves again that Christianity is not a set of doctrines, it's primarily the celebration of a mystery. And our text, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, is at the heart of that mystery. If you would take the microphone announcements at the first part of each day at Holden Village, you would have the mysteries of the Christian faith. For most of the year, someone says the Lord is risen, and the community responds, he is risen indeed. Then for 4 weeks, he is coming, and the response, he is coming soon. During the Christmas Epiphany season, we can well announce the Lord is born, and the community responds, he is born indeed. Every time we come to the Word or proclaim the Word, we have the texts for this night's service before us. You remember this morning, Libby, leading us in Matins, said, from the text that Bonnie just read, in old times God spoke by the prophets, but now he has spoken through his Son. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. God wished to speak. He wished to communicate. He had done that in that which is created. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth his handiwork. He had spoken by the prophets, but in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law. Christ is born. He is born indeed. And that is a mystery. We proclaim it. We live in it. But it is a mystery. They tell me that Albert Einstein, close to his death, had a very long visit, perhaps several, with a Lutheran pastor. And having heard the essence of the gospel and the mystery we're celebrating tonight, Einstein, in a gentle and I think somewhat humble way, said, when I approach the throne of judgment, I guess the only thing I can say is to my Creator, is you gave me a mind that was unable to accept the mystery of your gift, as Christians express it to me. It is a mystery, and we do not try to explain it. We are some of those who put all of our eggs in that basket, knowing we might be wrong. But we celebrate the mystery. The Word became flesh. The other thing that's in our text tonight, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. It locates for us our experience of God. And if we err, I think it will be in this part of the text. I think we have a great tendency to try to find God apart from the ordinary in our life. We have had this past Advent season a study here at Holden on spirituality, and we have tried to show that that which is the biblical understanding of spirituality, that you find God in that which is, not in a retreat from it. You find God in that which is real, not in some world that you try to ascend to. In that biblical spirituality, we have in this festival one of the keystones, and that is that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. It's in this world, and it's in all of the aspects of this life that we experience the God who speaks and the God who loves us. I think we tend to push him out of some of the experiences of life, and the festival of Christmas reminds us again that we find him in the midst of life, not in running from it. I don't know how your Advent preparation was. I think mine was especially helpful this year for me to celebrate this night. We studied spirituality for a week. We were reminded again of the biblical truth of that. And then I took a trip. And that trip was helpful on the variety of experiences of where friends of mine are experiencing Christ. I even spent an hour in the airport of Cleveland, Ohio, reading the paper and visiting with people on the day that city defaulted. I spent time with a woman named Magali Rodriguez, who had just come up from a labor camp in southern Florida, where migrant workers who are not organized and are not high-powered political people, for the first time in 10 years, got some gumption, stood up, and had found 7 growers who raised their turnip bins from 35 cents to 45 cents, the first raise in 12 years, and they had a victory to celebrate. I spent time with a pastor friend of mine who is on 100th Street in Manhattan, and I will admit to you, I can see God in the midst of life but have some trouble about seeing him in New York City. And here was a pastor, boyish gentleness, naivete, and toughness like you can't imagine, going back home to the midst of Manhattan to celebrate Christ in the midst of a city. That's also Advent. I asked him, how's it going? Well, they were ripped off in June. That took almost everything in the building. He went to the ALC convention, came home, and they had ripped off his house, which was next to the church. So now neither the church nor the pastor has many possessions. And he smiled. He said, that doesn't worry me quite as much as the party that's going on at my church when I get home tomorrow night. And I said, what's the party? Why are you having it? Well, he said, the precinct station is right across the street. And the police captain, in order to keep the morale up, gives all of the officers a party every year. And 2 years ago, the party included a few booze and a couple beers, and people looked in, and they saw policemen drinking, and everybody got in trouble. So the captain said, could we have it in your church? And I said, sure. And he said, last year I was down at the party, and the captain came in, looked around, and said, huh, that's a nice party. No fights yet, huh? And I looked at him and said, fights? Geez, who would we call? And then I came back to Holden. And do you realize that in the midst of all of the diversity of this world, in what we call the contrasts of environment, of urban and rural and mountains and plains, that lives are still fragile, that here at Holden we are really a community of failures, and that when I'm out there in the world, I share my successes out there. It's only with you, my friends, where I share my failures. But in the midst of that kind of life, in Manhattan and lower Florida, and a city that has defaulted, and this place where the continuing question is, can people find happiness in an abandoned mining town in the West? In the midst of all of that fragileness, we have a message that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And that's finally the good news. If that were not the good news, tonight I would have to be telling you that somehow you had to live somewhere else. Or that somehow you had to be different. Or that you couldn't be a failure. Or in the language of September that a few of you will know, God doesn't love you if you have pimples. But Christmas cuts through all that. And it says the Word became flesh and dwell among us. Hallelujah. Amen.